You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the New Year's edition of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and indeed this is being recorded in the evening of January 1st, 2025. Terrorism, when it's promoted and engaged in by the regime or its proxies, is either simply a method of warfare, or, in the case we're talking about today, an irrational response to impending defeat, as in the case of Kiev's use of it. The use of it fully accepted, promoted, equipped, financed by the U.S. and to a lesser extent, NATO. And terrorism becomes openly a policy of the regime, of the U.S., or its proxies. You can't really talk about it anymore, although the regime's political members are so isolated from the rest of the world that they really don't understand the cognitive problem here. As these words are being spoken, Russia continues to mop up the mercenaries employed by the U.S., and whatever Ukrainians remain really can't hold their positions anymore. Russian casualties are absolutely minimal. I saw something from Le Figaro citing something from the French army. Not really news, but this inability to hold positions or even have positions has been going on since at least the summer of 2022. Russian forces are advancing with minimal resistance. It snowballs because not that the Ukrainian energy grid was anything to begin with, but Moscow has engaged in maybe belated retaliatory destruction attacks on Kiev's energy infrastructure. And that's directly following on Kiev's attacks on Russian civilians. These kind of attacks on power plants that they built in the first place weren't really on the agenda a year ago. But today, the Russians have absolutely no choice. Kiev doesn't really have the resources or manpower to do much of anything. The total lack of troop rotation means these guys are dying and suffering, of course, needlessly, due to the nature of American policy, simply a bloodthirsty and demonic policy. But there's nothing for them to even build in terms of defense. Ukrainians don't have a front to hold. They're incapable of engaging in any kind of momentum. The steppe benefits the larger power, the Russian power, because there's so few places to hide. The battlefield is totally transparent. Any concentration of materiel is discovered immediately, and there's no other option for Kiev. But this now, thanks to the Kievan terror vector that the U.S. has promoted, Ukraine's use of terror tactics is just their last option. This war should have been over in the summer of 22. The Russians have always sought a few things. A neutral Ukraine, which was no problem when the Soviet Union was around, in places like Austria or Finland, but now Russia, with a very different kind of government, all of a sudden it's out of the question. And being neutral would also mean to be demilitarized, barred from NATO, and of course guarantees made towards whatever Russian speakers remain under the Kiev state. And that was the minimal set of demands. Now, the status of the Donbas was already, and Crimea, was a fait accompli anyway. No one wants to have any unification with the dying Kiev state. There's nothing to be gained from it. But these demands were pretty reasonable, and they were popular throughout Ukraine. Russian speakers would have been third-class citizens under the U.S.-controlled Kievan government. But apparently, unlike during the Cold War, this is too much for Washington, who began building an invading army. This is a country that desperately needed assets, investment, resources. Washington, not caring about any of that, instead built an army for Kiev to take the Donbass by force. Hence, Russia's invasion was both limited and preemptive. Should note that since 1990, Kiev hasn't been able to build a single power plant. And this is what happens when your economy collapses in 1990, or the early 1990s, and since then, no one really trusts the state or the economy sufficiently to invest much of anything. Now, the war just accelerated an ongoing and depressing trend I've been talking about for 20 years. Everything, with the nuclear, hydroelectric, thermal, everything built by the Russians. As of right now, though, about 80% of Ukraine's energy grid is non-functional, assuming it was functional in the first place. But regardless, the state of affairs, of course, can't be fixed, at least in part due to endless unchecked corruption. And any attempt to protect these facilities is hampered by many things. The manpower doesn't exist, or really the expertise anymore doesn't exist to fix any of this. And the process of its foreign ruling class, it's been really over years to strip the assets of the country. Defeat hangs over them. The elite have houses all over the world. And power is going to be a memory if this continues. U.S. does not care if Ukrainians suffer. In fact, has increased it many times, quite deliberately. Now, we're in the middle of winter here. But I do have to note that these power outages were the norm before the war. 20 hours a day, that sounds about right. In Syria, it was down to maybe an hour of power a day. All of this is part of a plan. And of course, it also affects the Russian-built nuclear power plants in the country. So, on December 13th of last year, a very large attack on the power grid was launched. The 12th, large-scale attack throughout the year, at least since August. The press said there were 93 missiles and 200 drones. I don't know where they're getting that from. And it was concentrated in the west, Ivano-Frankivsk specifically. And their local elites say it was the worst attack thus far. Ukraine has 9 nuclear reactors that are operational. Most have long since cut back on their output. December 13th meant that at least 5 of them were almost non-functional. But the way that nuclear power operates, the connections to the broader grid are fairly sophisticated and they have to be dependable. But then power has to return to it for the sake of cooling the system. And it's quite dangerous for any of that to be disrupted. But again, maintenance problems were the norm, endemic, prior to the war. But Kiev can simply blame the war for all of this. And the Kremlin said that this was in response to the pretty regular and now increasing terrorism of the dying Kiev regime. Donald Trump said to Time magazine that he disagreed with all of this, escalating a war and making it worse, which is, you know, to say the absolute least. And men in Ukraine are dying for the demonic and psychotic demands of the ruling class and the regime, seeking a wider war, even a nuclear one. Something that the ruling class in the West was dying to avoid during the Cold War, but now all bets are off. All told, I think 8 major power plants have been destroyed, 800 heat supply facilities in Ukraine, about $10 billion in damage. I think that's probably understated. And again, Kiev doesn't have the resources to do much about it. The overwhelming majority would love to end this war, but the U.S. won't allow it. Whatever economy Ukraine has is kept alive by foreign aid and in no small part by fantasy. So the country is now in even more serious trouble than it would have been had there been no war. Because when power goes down, everything is affected. Water, heating, sanitation, pretty much everything. I think by now, whatever's left of the population knows how to deal with this. But blackouts, power outages, you know, creating a climate of fear, knowing full well that this is going to be worse, get worse. And given the nature of the regime, the war is unlikely to end, but keeping the population in fear is part of the reason why there's been no uprising against Kiev. The regime will never report on any harsh treatment towards dissenters, which is a regular thing. Dissenters have been dealt with, and many of them have left the country anyway. But Zelensky, at the insistence of the U.S., will not negotiate at all. Therefore, things are just going to get worse. I'm looking at an article here from September of last year, repeating much of what I've said quite some time ago. When I say that this is a satanic ruling class, that the regime is demonic, that's quite literal in my case. Rather than negotiating to use terrorism, not just against those in Donbas or Crimea, which is bad enough, but now people much farther away from the combat zone. The Crocus City Hall massacre, Dagestan, Sevastopol. These have been mass murders. These have been massacres perpetrated by the regime. And it just proves what Kiev would do if they took back any of these places, which, thank God now, is impossible. And threats of more of this is continuing. During the Cold War, of course, this was unthinkable. Whether it be in Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, the U.S. would never touch the USSR. And throughout all of these wars, trade with the Soviet Union was constant. There was no such thing as sanctions. Jimmy Carter tried it in 1979. Now the regime continues to escalate tensions. This is to implement the Great Reset globally. Few writers have noted that any sanity coming out of the Kremlin, any actual statesmanship, which doesn't exist in the West, that will be taken as weakness. And as a result, more terror would be employed. I think the ultimate fantasy of Kiev right now is to bring the U.S. directly into the fight, like the Israelis want the U.S. to be directly involved against Iran. And at least in their mind, I can't imagine they're very stable in Kiev right now, or wherever they might be. That's the only way to prevent total and complete humiliation. And we can't rule it out, since there is absolutely nothing the regime considers beneath it when it comes to attacking Russia, a country that is not a threat to the West in any way. I wasn't shocked when I began reading about how Ukrainian intelligence, which essentially is the U.S., going to Syria to recruit fighters, specifically fighters that have some experience in explosives and terror tactics. Back in the fall, it was Sergei Lavrov spoke of Kiev going to Idlib, which is an American, terrorist-infested area, under Turkish and hence NATO control since at least, you know, 2012. So Lavrov said back then that he has recently received information that emissaries from the Ukrainian intelligence services are present in the Idlib de-escalation zone within the territory of the Syrian Arab Republic, and that they are recruiting local militants from Jabhat al-Nusra, now known as the HTS, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, with the intention of involving them in its nefarious operations. That means the two conflicts are closely related, which is no surprise to anybody. The Kiev regime and Western intelligence are focusing on now recruiting to the south, including in Sahara, because, you know, democracy demands that this occur. Now, both sides, both Kiev and the groups in Syria and elsewhere, are connected and being financed by the United States. Al-Qaeda, of course, is always at the forefront, to a great extent, an American creation and certainly financed by the U.S. right now. He mentioned that the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack from March of last year, I think the final toll was 145 deaths, of course, okayed by the U.S. And the investigation after that showed, of course, you know, American involvement. And that's what resulted in these strikes on the intelligence assets across Ukraine, although, frankly, that should have been done a long time before. Now, the attack on Crocus was claimed by ISIS-K, which is a U.S. asset based in Afghanistan, at least last I checked. And, of course, the U.S. is working with them to try to do damage to the Taliban, despite the U.S. being driven out of there. So Lavrov was very clear that the GUR, or the main Directorate of Intelligence, which is connected to the Defense Ministry in Kiev, was connected to that and other forms of terror. And those that have been captured, the escape routes and instructions have been very clear, going across the Russo-Ukrainian border, all of this planned in detail. And it's no surprise when he says, and Kiev fully echoes, that more of this stuff is going to be planned and carried out in the future. The manpower being recruited usually from Central Asia, but also now from the post-Assad Syria. So Idlib was a perfect ground for this kind of thing, since they've been fighting the Russian and Syrian militaries for a decade or more. Part of the reason Assad is no longer there is that Turkey has been preventing the total defeat of these groups going back years. In the Syrian and Russian offensive operations in northwestern Syria. And of course, as we all know, late last year, Assad was forced to abandon the country. And as a result, according to plan, Syria has been reduced to massacres, slaughters, everything that the U.S. has brought upon any country it's been involved in, from Libya to Iraq. But the regime has long since been involved in that kind of actual real terror operation, and it's been leading and, of course, created the anti-Assad forces since 2011 at the very early, the very earliest, at latest, I'm sorry. It goes back years before then, as has the Mossad. So Kiev, CIA, working together with the HTS and the various Turkish-backed terror groups, and there's no plan to rebuild Syria. There's no plan to govern it. And there's a Turkish newspaper or a news outlet, Aydinlik, which, you know, reported on this long before Lavrov's comments. These groups are entirely destructive. They're goons. They can't govern anything. If it wasn't for American money and support, they couldn't function. Apparently, the deal was Kiev would give its American-provided drones in exchange for manpower. Apparently, it was June of last year that occurred. I think it goes back further than that. And even certain, Kimik group, connected to the GUR, whatever's left of their special forces, was involved in some of the fighting in the southeastern outskirts of Aleppo. Again, every penny of this coming from the U.S. That took place on September 15th of last year. But all of this is happening because of the complete demolition of their battlefield performance. Sabotage, terrorism on Russian civilians, the attempt is to create internal tension and division, of course, which has failed miserably. But these sort of groups, from the Ukrainian military straight to ISIS, all of this is with American money, NATO-sourced weapons, groups that the U.S. created in the first place and that it also pretends to fight. And I don't know if you've noticed, but all the attacks on Turkey has ceased. There was attempted color revolutions against Ankara, and of course that's all gone. One of the more obnoxious, and I saw this in April, I don't think I mentioned it, but the FSB intercepted a shipment of explosives, and the bombs were disguised as icons, Orthodox icons of all things. It would have, of course, was meant to murder innocent people, especially Orthodox people, actually specifically Orthodox people, which always reminds me there's probably a Jewish motive behind it. Now, this was seized between Russia and Latvia, and even though it was labeled in Ukrainian, there was a way to launder it. It went all over Europe before it showed up at the border. Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, as a way to disguise its origin and its... And really, its purpose. Within these icons, they found 4 homemade bombs, 10 pounds of the plastic explosive, and things like detonators, even an RPG, or at least pieces of it. Packages contained a foundation for explosives, hexogen or RDX, which could be used on its own. I believe largely produced in Britain. It's the foundation for things like Semtex. And everything from, you know, industrially produced fuses, delay mechanisms. And it's pretty common that this is what special forces use. So clearly it was accomplished by them, the same people who went to Idlib and connected with the United States. I'll repeat myself, nothing like that was ever contemplated in the Soviet era. I mean, Vietnam was allowed to die, and the U.S. abandoned Saigon and never once stopped trading with the USSR or Hanoi. For that matter, only nationalism gets this kind of response, never Marxism. Now, the reason that they used icons, and I think there's a whole bunch of reasons for that, but coming under a religious label, the attempt was to avoid certain aspects of customs, or at least avoiding suspicion. But knowing full well that there's nothing that the U.S. and Kiev won't do, it was quickly identified by Russian intelligence. But using icons is a message. It's not merely to avoid suspicion, but the people who it would be used against, of course, are not military. The man was detained roughly around the same time, trying to smuggle explosives across the border, admitting that the final destination was Moscow. And it's, once Kiev clearly was defeated, spreading terror was all really that was left to them. That the U.S. has been reduced to these tactics is now pretty well known, at least outside of the U.S., which can only help the Russians. I mean, the Crocus attack was largely an American operation, and as a result, Russia escalated its attacks against Ukrainian command centers deep into the country. I mean, the Kiev regime has no capacity to act on its own, and it's just a proxy. But these kind of incursions, they're becoming very frequent. The Belgorod and Kursk, this was just the beginning. And this is what happens when they can't win on the battlefield. But to think that this is going to allow ordinary people to become hostile to the government or the SMO is ridiculous. The election results alone show this. That they have to cancel elections in different countries shows you what liberalism and democracy really is as far as the regime is concerned. Now, the more Russia's attacked, the more its population supports it. I mean, at least in part, because the economy is doing much better than their neighbors and certainly better than the U.S. And since Ukraine doesn't have an economy, it's almost incomparable in this case. The regime is what's facing an uncertain future, importing as many foreigners as possible, not just to control labor costs, but to serve as a reserve army against any native protest. And the Russian reaction is always like the Iranian. It's always relatively measured. They don't want to give any justification or shock to global public opinion. And the Israelis can get away with it for the most part. But even then, there'd be no justification for Kiev's actions. Less than a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, the same GUR published a list of, I think, about 550 ships of the so-called Shadow Fleet. Of that, there are about 240 tankers. Now, the GUR now is just a terror organization. And that it's quite a number of ships. It's about 17 or 20% of the world's oil tanker fleet in total. It's strange because the GUR demanded that these ships be sanctioned. But all of Russia's oil transport has been sanctioned already, and they've failed miserably. So when they use the word sanction, they've got to be thinking of something else. Double talk is pretty common. Blocking any oil export from Russia is effectively impossible. And the regime really is hesitant to do this, really, because it would give the oil firms an excuse to raise prices. And in that case, to the stratosphere. Now, not that that's a big problem, but it would be obviously because of American action. And the consequences could be severe, especially for places like Germany. Now, 3 days after that list was made public, two Russian tankers, I think it was the Volgoneft 212 and then another one, 239, one sailor was killed. There was a substantial oil spill. They were transporting fuel oil, and it was near the Kerch Strait, just north of the Crimean Bridge. Both ships actually were quite close to it. Strictly a civilian bridge, but it's often targeted by the regime. It almost certainly was an attack from them. The crews were rescued using kamikaze drone boats or mines. As far as I know, Kiev hasn't said much about that, but the propaganda outlets are already bragging about it. And it's not just that this, you know, fleet exists, but given the profits coming from the 10-year deal with India and many other places, and the alliance, the growing alliance between New Delhi and Moscow, this is really their only response. The seaborne oil exports from Russian ports, this Indian deal's almost half of it. Rosneft, anyway. So this is a big deal as far as the regime goes, and its oil firms, not just, you know, because they're cut out of it, but the sanctions are nullified by it. American oil companies want to take this revenue for itself. But all of these actions have minimal effect. Clearly, the attack on these ships is a terror attack. These are not military vessels. But the very fact that both the Kievan regime and its American sponsors have not been shy about talking about terrorism, it means that at this point, anyone can be targeted for any reason. There have been so many assassination attempts and actual successful assassinations. Scientists, journalists, whatever. Even the attempt to murder Putin himself and the defense minister. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the murder of General Igor Kirillov, who I have mentioned before in a different context. He's not involved in combat. Yes, he is a military figure. But there was a reason that they murdered him. He's the head of the Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Protection Unit in the Russian armed forces, killed by an IED, Ryazansky prospect, actually, in the street in Moscow. But what he did do is investigate the Pentagon-run biological weapons and warfare programs in Kiev, and not just within NATO-occupied Ukraine, but around the planet. And I went to a Turkish pro-terrorist newspaper, Clash Report, late last year, and it was the SBU charged him in absentia and sought sanctions on him personally, which I thought already existed, and that he's legitimate because he carried out war crimes. They didn't say what war crimes, they simply made it up, parroted uncritically by the media. He wasn't involved in combat. But of course, Kiev does use poison gas in their desperation. But murdering him is more to cover up what he did, what he discovered, than any kind of military apparatus. Now, we know that the U.S. and Kiev was behind it because it has all the marks of an American operation. He's a citizen of Uzbekistan. This guy, they found him, hired by Kiev. They gave him $100,000 and also a promise to relocate him to a European city as an oppressed migrant. And he received detailed instructions. He received the explosive device from the Ukrainians directly. He rented a car with a surveillance camera, and he was able to transmit the actual live feed to the organizers of the attack. The organizers being near the front in eastern Ukraine, and the Ukrainian CIA, watching the live feed, chose the exact moment to press the button. Now, Kiev often uses explosives to kill its opponents. They usually use mercenaries from Central Asia. In cases like Daria Dugina, Maxim Fomin, very much the same way. Even the Crocus City Hall massacre used terrorists from Tajikistan. They know that the media won't connect the dots, so they can afford to be sloppy. But since 2022, the Russian government, because of Kirillov, has been releasing many reports showing and demonstrating the biomilitary activities in Ukraine from the West, he led that effort. He published all kinds of data on prominent figures from NATO and firms in the production of biological weapons. The Soros Foundation, Big Pharma, both from Western Europe and the U.S., are heavily involved in this, including Hunter Biden. And this shows you how tightly interwoven the regime has become. And it did produce somewhat of a crisis in the pharmaceutical lobby. The case, you know, the evidence was impossible to deny. It's been exposed, even may have had a damaging effect on their stock price. So he irritated Western oligarchs. He was able to prove their murderous intent. And beyond that, the use of chemical weapons by the U.S. via Kiev is increasingly well known, especially in the East. There's too many Russian military personnel who've been poisoned by toxic substances that are only used in chemical warfare. The U.S. is the only country in the world, although they may be, Israel might be, that has a publicly maintained stockpile of chemical weapons, probably the only possible supplier of these materials to Ukraine. But Kirillov is the one that connected all the dots. And so he was marked for death now for some time. Again, all of this has to come from the U.S. since Kiev is a proxy agent. It has no sovereignty. So he did cause quite a bit of damage to the Western pharmaceutical industry. And it shows you, really, that any negotiation with the regime at this point is out of the question. It isn't like the Cold War because the U.S. was not anti-communist. But both Marxism and liberalism are vehemently anti-nationalist, and that explains, for the most part, the differences between American policy during the Cold War versus now. And there's no point of connection between the two. It's completely different. Now, given the alleged permission that those controlling Joe Biden gave to fire hundreds of missiles on December 18th, it was Rostov Oblast in southwestern Russia, using American-made, the ATACMS and the Storm Shadows. But all of these were shot down. I think there was one Storm Shadow that made it through, which hit an oil refinery. But on the 19th of December, Putin held his, you know, the big year-end conference with reporters. That's where he, you know, released the information on the Oreshnik hypersonic. And he even challenged the U.S. to a duel on these. you know, pick a place. We'll shoot it. We'll see if you can do anything about it. He said, we're ready for this contest, this experiment. Of course, it's never going to happen. The regime could never expose itself that way. But on December 20th, other hypersonics were used. Not a single Oryshnik was used, although the media said it was. There were only three missile types used, Iskander, one of the Kinzhals, and even the KN-23 from North Korea. But nothing that NATO has could come even close to the secondary weapons, let alone the Oryshnik, and even things still being planned. The three missile types I just mentioned are better than Mach 10, despite initial media reports. And the targets were the command posts of the infamous SBU, the Luk Design Bureau, and a few Patriot batteries. And this was, at least in part, in response to the Kirillov murder. These are deadlier weapons than the HIMARS or the Mars or anything else. But even the older, but I mean, I'll be upgraded, Russian weapons, even used by Kiev, are far more dangerous than the NATO source systems. That's why they're the first ones to be targeted by Moscow, not the American-made ones. Now, of course, the U.S. says that any successful hit is attributed to the American-based systems, but that's rarely true. The Russian military says, no, these were our, albeit older, weapons that were used. And the same goes for the S-300 SAMs used in Kiev. You know, the Russian military obliterates the MIM-104 or the... The Russians lost a radar station in a recent strike. But the attacks on Ukraine have not been intercepted. Even the secondary lower-order weapons have not been intercepted, despite the mythology of Kiev. Things like the Design Bureau, you know, this was missile production, and they call it the R-360 Neptune, but that's based on the Russian anti-ship missile. They're even using the older Smerch MLRS, or the Multiple Launch Rocket Systems. They've had more success with Russian systems than with NATO ones. But the production, upgrading of these weapons in Kiev and Western Ukraine are disrupted primarily by the Russians as a top priority. Kiev's claims, they're laughably absurd intercept statistics. It's simply made up, kind of like the Israelis. They were false, they were used for propaganda, and they're not shooting any of these down. I'm sure the American media reported on that. It's simply a lie. And the strategic missile forces of Russia confirm that they're going to get even more formidable weapons in the near future. And one of them is the Osina, the ICBM, which comes from the Yars. And that was the foundation of the Oryshnik. The Russian ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kilnin, says that the British, despite their bizarrely hostile position towards Russia, the existence of these hits in Western Ukraine and Kiev by these other weapons has reined in some of the more recklessly aggressive British policy, and that they've started to moderate their rhetoric. They've taken a more cautious approach, despite that the UK has very limited military capabilities at this point. But again, that goes to show that NATO understands one thing, and that's the language of violence, and that is the only thing and the only way to communicate with the regime today. Thank you, everyone. Happy New Year, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.